This is Dr. Michael Blumenfield. I'm here with Dr. Doug Ingram, who was the 43rd president of the American Academy of Psychoanalysis and Dynamic Psychiatry in 1997 to 1998. Welcome, Doug.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Michael.
Let's start with looking back and any reminiscence that you have about what made you want to be a doctor back then.
Well, I think the reason that I was motivated to be a doctor was really parental influence, family influence. I would have been the first doctor in a family that greatly valued the medical profession. And not quite able to convince myself that I was especially talented in any particular area, music, art, athletics. It seemed like something that I would be drawn to, and in fact, I was.
Mm-hmm. And where did you grow up and go to college and then to medical school?
I grew up the first 8 years in Brooklyn and then Valley Stream for a few years, and then still on Long Island in Woodbury, where I attended Syosset High School, graduating in 1960. And then I went off to Columbia College until 1964, and then straight to NYU Medical School, graduating in 68.
And can you trace what made you decide to go into psychiatry?
That's actually rather easy for me. I've been bewildered by myself and by people around me ever since I could remember. And the whole question of what constituted the person sort of drove me. And again, in the absence of anything that would take me from that question, that actually was a burning question. And my high school readings of Dostoevsky did nothing to help me answer that question. So when it came down to it, I found that psychiatry was the closest discipline within medicine that would address that question for me. What is it that constitutes personhood?
You know, can you define a little bit more as you recall? What did you mean by personhood?
What is it to be a person? What is the self? I knew that Freud had explored all of the aspects of the psychic apparatus, as it was called in those days. I don't think we bother with those terms too much anymore. But that was really quite fascinating to me. You know, what accounts for the variety of desires and motivations and all of the proscriptions and prescriptions and shoulds and entitlements, all the strange things that occur to us in our dreams, and how to make sense of all of that. That seems so much more exciting than EKGs or how the biochemistry of renal failure. And so I was drawn to psychiatry because I thought that would address the question that was most interesting to me. It had philosophical, ethical, and actually legal implications that I found quite fascinating.
And what about your residency? Do you recall anything special about your residency? Any of your teachers or colleagues?
My residency was vacuous, and I very quickly found psychiatry to be vacuous. In those days, there was really so much less in the way of brain science than there is today, and the medications available were not very, very interesting. I mean, what is the difference between Stelazine and Melaril did not compel me. And so within a few months, I found myself applying to the Horney Institute, where I very quickly realized I was going to be able to address this question about personhood that I had been sort of struggling with, both in myself and about others.
And did you enter your own psychoanalysis during your residency?
Yes, within a few months, I commenced analysis and classes, and the residency supported me in that. I had actually the experience during my internship of pricking myself with a needle that had an addict had been using, and I came down with hepatitis. A friend of mine, a girl that I was seeing, was in treatment with a horn eye analyst, and so I took the time that I was laid up convalescing with the hepatitis to read all of horn eye, and I found it really quite to the point, and so I was delighted to become a trainee at the horn eye institute.
And this is while you were a resident at, it was St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. The hospital is, you know, went out of business just a couple of years ago, I'm sorry to say. But it was a good residency from the point of view that that I learned a lot about psychosis. But basically, it gave me the time and the freedom and the opportunity to moonlight, which I did at the Manhattan Bowery Project. I worked with alcoholics. It gave me what I needed to pursue my psychoanalytic training, which is really where my heart lay.
Now, you early on in your career, you did some work and projects with alcoholics. Did that come from this project?
The Manhattan Bowery Project,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had no special interest in alcoholism. I never really much cared to have a drink except once in a while. But the opportunity to make some money to pay for my analysis brought me to do some moonlighting down on the Bowery with these men, and I quickly learned a lot about alcoholism, and I enjoyed working with them and got to know them very well. They got to know me. I was the Bowery psychiatrist there, and then I went on after that to become a psychiatrist in the alcoholism service at Beth Israel Hospital, and eventually I became outpatient director of outpatient services. But also I became interested in other kinds of addictive disorders, mostly eating disorders. At my work at the institute, as a candidate, I also worked at the Karen Horn Eye Clinic, and because of the mentorship I received from Theodore Isaac Rubin, who is quite a writer in the popular literature and contributed a lot to promoting psychoanalytic thinking during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I began working with patients with overeating disorders. It was felt that if I knew a lot about alcoholism, I probably could be pretty good about food addiction. And so I began working there and doing that and finding great value in it.
You met Rubin. I seem to recall that he wrote a screenplay or a story that was adapted to a screenplay. Was it David and Lisa or something like that?
Yes, David and Lisa, and it was Theodore Isaac Rubin. And yes, that was his, and he wrote many other books, and he wrote a column for the Ladies Home Journal. So he was a significant figure within psychiatry, and in my view, woefully unacknowledged. He had done.
Do you have any other recollections about your supervisors and mentors?
Well, I had wonderful supervisors and mentors at the Horn Eye Institute. My analyst, Isidore Portnoy, was a wonderful man of surpassing integrity and compassion, and I worked with him for hundreds and hundreds of hours. My supervisors, Lou Hott, who you know, who is your uncle, as we found out recently.
Right, that's correct, yeah.
And I learned a great deal about the you know, the plain old politics of the profession. Antonia Wenkart was an existential analyst, and I learned a lot about that perspective, that philosophical perspective within psychoanalysis. And Alexander Reed Martin, who was very involved with Shakespearean writing, and so I read all of Shakespeare during my work with him, and that was a wonderful experience and greatly shaped my approach to psychoanalytic therapy.
Mm-hmm. You were practicing in Manhattan during that time, is that right?
Yes.
And
what
was it like practicing in Manhattan during the 70s and when you were there?
Well, at the time when I was in my candidacy and for quite a while afterwards, I was hell-bent on seeing patients at least three times a week, and I was able to do that with a fair number of patients. I didn't charge very much, which made it easier for patients to come multiple times a week. But then as time went on and my personal life took on the kinds of obligations that make it more difficult to charge low fees, and the times changed, so psychoanalytic treatment with multiple times per week began to decline. I moved into seeing patients less frequently, began using medications, and now I see just a few patients more than once a week.
Were there any particular type of patients that tended to gravitate towards you?
The referrals that came to me were, some alcoholic patients, patients with eating disorders, thankfully, due to the connections that I developed as a result of my work with Ted Rubin. And yet mainly it was and continues to be rather high-functioning garden variety neurotic patients with a mix of anxiety and depressive disorders.
Now, you were a training analyst also, is that correct?
Yes, soon after my graduation, I was catapulted into that position at the Horn Eye Institute, and I became a member of the faculty council and a training and supervising analyst, and I think I was probably the youngest to occupy those positions in the Horn Eye group in the early 80s. I had by then become medical director of the of the Karen Horn Eye Clinic, and so I was carrying the responsibilities of that position as well.
Mm-hmm. And you also were a training analyst and teaching at the New York Medical College also?
Yes. Curiously, I as a result of my early connection with folks in the academy, I became friends with people at New York Medical College. And because of certain political issues that arose at Horn Eye, I removed myself, and the faculty of New York Medical College took me on, and I became active there as a senior analyst and training supervising analyst at that institution. I was later rehabilitated at Horn Eye and became its dean in 1997 and 98, the same period of time that I was president of the academy, in fact.
Uh-huh. Now, there was one particular case that received a great deal of publicity in the popular press. Would you like to talk about that case?
Well, that was really quite an adventure. Yes, I'll tell you about it. It's in the lineage of the Tarasov cases, a candidate in New York Medical College psychoanalytic program came to me to be his training analyst, and so I worked with him. And about 6 months into his treatment, he disclosed that he had feelings about boys, sexual feelings, and he spoke about these. He was a psychiatrist already and a licensed physician, and I was concerned about him because I was not clear whether these reports from my patient were entirely without impulse, and so I consulted Irving Bieber, and he said, stay the course, hold the line, keep treating him, unless he mentions a specific person that he is interested in molesting, just hold the line. Do you hear me?
Yes, I do. And Dr. Bieber was apparently one of your was a esteemed colleague. Of course, you were a training analyst at the time, but he also is a known expert in sexual problems, right?
That's right. That's why he was the chief person that I consulted. I also consulted lawyers who specialize in this kind of thing, and some people just ran from it like the plague. One person stating that there's no way that you're going to get out of this thing. If this guy acts on it, you're going to be nailed as well.
Now, the reason that you're talking about it freely is because this whole case and this whole situation was ultimately written up in major publications, the New York Times and other places, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It happened that several years later, after this man did in fact molest two boys, that he was imprisoned, and I was subsequently sued by one of his victims, and that lawsuit did not actually come to fruition until the mid or late 1990s, and the attorneys for the plaintiff let it be known that this was an interesting case, and it got played up really quite a bit. It appeared in the New York Times and the front page of the Metropolitan section, and then was picked up everywhere else. And I appeared on a couple of shows, most notably the Johnny Cochran show. And
this patient was a child. A child psychiatrist, or he was studying to be a child psychiatrist. Is that?
That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So why don't you pick it up after Dr. Bieber advised you, as you described?
Well, I continued to work with the patient, who of course was a physician himself, and he was moonlighting. And then at some point in the autumn, I guess, of 1987. He molested two children, two young boys, at two different hospitals, so there was no question about it. And he was shortly thereafter convicted of pedophilia, and he was put away. And that was the end of it for me for some time to come. It was only after the lawsuit commenced that I was drawn back into this question.
Have any ethical precepts or any guidelines in your mind come out of this case that you would pass on to future psychiatrists who might find themselves in this situation?
Yes. The principle that I upheld was confidentiality. I followed the laws and Tarasoff, of course, and I consulted widely. But there are some circumstances that can arise that are extremely ambiguous and difficult, and one has to just sort of ride that horse of ambiguity that will take you don't know where. But you just go ahead and ride it, because to do otherwise would be either unethical or illegal. And I knew that I was stuck. I knew that this was likely to come back and come back at me, and it did. And I continued to follow through. I had guidance, legal and psychiatric. That is, I didn't. You know, psychiatrist friends of mine were, you know, were helpful to me in sort of figuring the thing out. But some things are so thorny that you just cannot get away from them, and you have to just sort of do the right thing. And here, it turned out that the laws in New York are different from the laws in Connecticut. If the law was applied in New York, I would have been fine. There would have been no question of a lawsuit. But the laws were applied in Connecticut, where a class of endangered victims is sufficient for a plaintiff to bring a case. In New York, it has to be a specific victim that's named in order for a case to be brought. And so the laws of Connecticut were applied, and so I was drawn into this. But, you know, I mean, this kind of situation is not so unique. Of course, what happened with me in this, it was kind of amusing somewhat, you know, 20 years later when I attended a continuing medical education program in forensics, where I'm sitting in the audience with a couple of hundred other psychiatrists, and suddenly I hear the case that I was named in come up and discussed. It was amusing. I didn't know whether to stand up and take a bow or to slide under the desk and seek for cover.
Well, that certainly was an interesting experience, and I really appreciate that you shared it with us so future generations can appreciate how you dealt with it. Of course, you've done a lot of teaching of medical students and residents and psychoanalytic candidates over the years. Have you noticed any changes throughout the years that you've been teaching?
Well, yes, and I think those of us in the field have shared a kind of regret or even sorrow that the interest in what we had valued so highly, the psychoanalytic paradigm, has either been so integrated into the society that it's kind of ho-hum, and so that young psychiatric residents and medical students are turning away from it, are not even recognizing it any more than perhaps some early psychiatrists might have recognized phrenology. So I regret that, because I think that what we have to offer is really so very valuable, and of course addresses the question that I found myself burning with, a question of personhood and what is that. But of course, now there are so many medications on the market, and so much more has been learned about neurophysiology and brain science and so forth, that I can understand that these changes would occur, these shifts in how medical students and psychiatric residents would regard psychodynamic psychiatry, psychoanalysis.
Okay. Well, before we get to your view of the future, let's get back to how you became interested and involved with the American Academy of Psychoanalysis and Dynamic Psychiatry.
Well, as a candidate, you know, I wondered what happens to me in terms of my connections. I knew that ordinary run-of-the-mill psychiatry held no interest for me, but that psychoanalytic treatment did, and I asked, and I found out that the American Academy of Psychoanalysis, as it was then called, was available to me, and I could join as a candidate, and I did. This is back in the 70s, early 70s. And I found myself with a lot of like-minded people who I made friends with and stayed in touch with over the years and went to meetings and presented papers and sat on panels. And this became my professional group. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted to have such a professional group.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any of the people who were running the organization and as you became involved with it as a new member?
Oh, yes. I mean, people like Arnold Wise and Paul Dintz and Ian Alger and Frank Crutzen and Marvin Drellick, Sheila Klebanow, Irving Bieber, Silvio Olarte, Joe Merlino came a little bit later. Mm-hmm. It's a long list of right. good people.
Right. And then as you worked your way into the organization, you ultimately became president in 1997. Were there any special issues that were going on with the Academy when you were an officer and when you became president?
Well, nothing very special at the time that I became president. But during my presidency, we had rather an unfortunate episode that was extremely distracting. The executive director of the time, who had won our trust and was so competent, sitting in my office, and one day got a phone call from our accountant that there was some oddities in the books, and this led very quickly to my calling a special meeting of the interim council, and after some further investigation, it really did not take very long. We realized had embezzled a substantial amount of money from the Academy, and so I would meet from time frequently during February and March of '98 with Sam Slipp, Silvio Olarte, Joe Merlino, Sheila Klebanow, Ian Alger, Paul Dintz, and of course the other officers who were with me. Silvio Olarte was past president, Joe Merlino was secretary, and Barbara Bess, who as treasurer sort of bore the brunt of the issue of this embezzlement. And so we were faced not only with the fact of the lost money, but what to do about our office and what to do about ourselves, because it was so critical that we hung together, that we did not begin pointing fingers, which is very easy, a very easy thing to happen in an organization. So, you know, I was very pleased that we were able to hang together. All the officers offered their resignation, including myself, and the resignation was rejected by the Board of Trustees. So we continued to do what we could do, which was to conduct business, and and then, unfortunately, some of the heavy work of the residual issues of what to do fell to my to the next president, Sam Slipp. But he was terrific about it. He made it all work out, and I know that it was extremely distracting for him during his presidency, and I regret that he had to deal with that. But that was the primary issue, and all the other things that go into a presidency faded before the enormity of the problems that embezzlement created for us.
You know, since this is a piece of history of the Academy, I'm wondering if, as you look back at it, what do you think, was there a defect in the way the Academy was structured that this happened, and do you have any thoughts about that? I assume whatever defect there was obviously was rectified. But why do you think that was able to happen? What was missing?
I think that what happened was the signing of checks. We did not realize at the time that the treasurer had authorized a signature stamp, and because of that, it became very easy for a person to embezzle.
How long had it been going on?
I don't actually know how long, but probably over several months. It would have been picked up a year earlier by the accountant if it had been going on for too long.
I see. So in other words, the check on the system was that the accountant reviews the books every year.
But I think that we were somewhat lax and failed to recognize that we had opened a door to someone who could take advantage.
How was it resolved ultimately with him? Were the police involved and things like that?
As I know, Sam Slip would know better, actually. But I believe what happened is that we arranged it so that he would repay the money that was taken, and there would be no charges filed pending the return of that money, mm-hmm. so that he had the opportunity to make good on what he had taken without having to undergo anything criminal. But I may be in error on that. I don't recall it
okay.
too well.
Well, I appreciate what you do recall, and again, thank you for that piece of history that we now have recorded here. Now, you, because of your talent, were the editor of a few of our professional journals, including being the editor for 10 years of the Journal of the Academy. In fact, you completed your term, I believe, last year, right? In 2012?
Or yes, that's right. 2011, I guess it was.
2011, so you were editor of the Academy Journal for 10 years, as well as other journals. So let me ask you, what was that like, and what changes did you see, and what changes did you make in the journal during your time as editor of the journal?
Well, I was delighted to be elected to that position. I had previously been editor of the Horn Eye Journal for 10 years. So I had a good sense of editorship and what was required. My world, my universe of psychoanalysts was really the Academy. I hadn't really ventured very far outside. I knew that, of course, there were many other psychoanalysts out there, but the people that I knew were in the Academy, and so I tried to stimulate publication by our members, and I was very pleased that we were able to generate a lot of papers from among our own members as opposed to those outside our group. But the downside of that, of course, was also that we did not have publications by those from other groups, or at least not as many as we might have wanted. I was pleased that my successor, Richard Friedman, has a larger world of psychoanalysts who he can draw upon for articles, and he has already done so, and I'm very pleased to see that.
Mm-hmm. You of course yourself have written many articles and made many presentations. Any particular subjects have interested you over the years and stand out, or particular papers that you're pleased that you wrote or want to mention at this point?
Well, I got very taken up with the postmodern concepts, and sought to apply those to psychodynamic thinking, and so I wrote a series of papers on language and metaphor and postmodernism and poststructuralism and things like that, and then the postmodern fashion sort of fell away, so I sort of gave that up, although of course I'm still very interested in the narrativist perspective and how thinking about language and listening to language in a close way is very valuable in the clinical circumstance. Now I'm interested in a very different kind of thing, namely the the experience of treating patients who are caregivers of those with major neurocognitive disorders like Alzheimer's, which is a kind of a very different sort of direction. But still, I'm interested in the language that we use either as therapists or as patients in our work.
Mm-hmm. You wrote one article that struck, you wrote many articles that were really very very important, and you've made so many contributions. There was one article that caught my eye recently that you wrote a while back, and that was an article about the computer in your office. Do you remember that article? You wrote
that
it.
That must be 1,000 years ago.
You wrote it in 1987. So I was struck by how you very early on appeared to appreciate that the computer was going to have a role in our office in the future. So I think that was an example of your ability to see into the future.
Oh, thank you. If I had followed that forward, I would have gone into computer science and software generation, but I did not pursue that, and I'm sitting along with my laptop like everyone else.
Well, we're glad that you stayed in our profession. You know, currently you're heading up a very important task force for the Academy. I think something that's going to make some major changes in the Academy. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the changes that this membership task force that you're heading up hopes to bring about, and why that's important.
Well, over the years of my membership in the Academy, I, like the rest of us, have witnessed a steady decline in the number of psychiatrists seeking psychoanalytic training. And psychoanalytic training is probably at the heart of psychodynamic psychiatry. Early on, there was a great question of whether we would open the doors to non-psychiatrists or whether we would stay only psychiatric, only medical. I believe that was probably in the 70s. And it was decided that we would stay medical. As a result, the decline in the number of psychoanalytically trained psychiatrists has affected the membership of the Academy to the point that now the Academy faces the great question of what to do about its membership. Do you have to be psychoanalytically trained? To what degree do you need to have psychodynamic experience to become a member of the Academy? And so after a review of the statistics in terms of our membership and the general sense of the era, we came to the conclusion that that probably we needed to open the doors to psychiatrists who professed a meaningful interest in psychodynamics, and that we would look to make those psychiatrists full members of the Academy in order to keep the Academy alive and to keep the promise of psychodynamics going into the future. So that's the general mission of the task force and what we hope to see come about in the next year or so.
So you're giving us an inkling into your vision of the future of psychoanalytic and psychodynamic therapy. Is there anything that you want to add about what you think the future will be, what the future Doug Ingrams will be doing in their office?
I think that they'll be doing psychodynamic psychiatry like I am doing now. They'll be prescribing medication. They will, to some degree, make a decision to earn a little bit less money than they might by seeing patients for longer periods and listening to them very closely, appreciating issues of transference, countertransference, dream interpretation, free association, resistance, repression, and all the defenses and so forth. that they'll be doing that, and that they will not fall prey to merely making money, but rather they'll hold on to a vision of themselves and a vision of their work that they do as being with the person and helping the person to deal with the suffering that they have in their lives. That's what I think will be.
Well, thank you very much. Any other thoughts that you want to make before we conclude this very interesting interview?
Well, I just want to say thank you, Michael, for the opportunity to talk a little bit about all of these things, and I know that you're engaged in this project, and wish you the very best.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much, Dr. Doug Ingram.